The headlines this hour. Tehran says anti-Iran separatist terror groups should soon evacuate their military bases in northern Iraq, based on a deal between the two countries. An Israeli airstrike hits Aleppo International Airport in Syria, causing damage to the runway and putting it out of service. And a French politician says the planned ban on the wearing of abaya dresses by Muslim girls in schools proves the government's obsessive rejection of Muslims.
Welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
The Iranian Foreign Ministry says the Iraqi government has vowed to disarm and to relocate anti-Iran separatist terror groups based in Iraq's Kurdistan region by September 19 of this year. Spokesman Nasser Kanani said Baghdad will do that based on a deal with Tehran. He said under the deal, the Iraqi government will evacuate terrorist barracks and transfer them to pre-planned camps. Kanani said the next month's deadline will not be extended. He added if the deal is not implemented, Iran will take its own measures to ensure its security. The spokesman made the comments in his weekly press briefing. He also spoke about the illegal presence of U.S. forces in the region, including in Syria.
Developments on the ground there also show that the presence, military presence of U.S. in Syria is illegal. It also perpetuates instability, and it creates some space for operations of terrorist groups on Syrian soil. So the U.S. administration, on the basis of international law and also on the basis of a request by the Syrian government, is required to leave Syrian soil.
Also in his remarks, Kanani said the U.S. government should clarify its position regarding terrorists and the murderers of the Iranian people. He made the comment in response to a question about a meeting between a senior U.S. official and family members of Jamshid Sharmad on Friday. He's a ringleader of Tandar terror group that carried out dozens of terrorist acts across Iran in the past years. Iran sentenced Sharmad to death in February of this year. Iran has started gas production from Phase 11 of the South Pars gas field in the Persian Gulf, south of the country. The gas production began after a 20-year delay. Iran has blamed that on the failure of foreign companies to fulfill their commitments under contracts with the country. President Ebrahim Raisi attended the ceremony to launch the gas production in the port city of Basaliyeh. He praised the project as a great achievement accomplished by Iranian experts. Raisi also hailed Iran's technical and technological capabilities. He said many countries like South Africa and Venezuela have called for using those capabilities and the Iranian assistance in their projects. The South Pars Phase 11 is shared with Qatar and will increase Iran's gas production by 56 million cubic meters a day. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran has unveiled the homegrown radionuclide with applications in various fields. The radioisotope cesium-137 is produced by nuclear fission and can also be derived from nuclear waste. Gisumi Shahmadi explains.
Cesium-137, Iran's new solution for radioactive waste management and a leap forward in nuclear medicine, not to mention its many applications in industrial gauges. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran made the announcement while unveiling the homegrown radioisotope, which is currently produced at laboratory scales.
What's important to know is that cesium-137 itself is a strategically important product. With a half-life of about 30 years, it has various applications. It plays a key role in industrial gauges, for example, particularly in our oil and gas sector, and in order to measure the flow of fluids accurately. Also, for the calibration of industrial measuring tools, its long half-life is a great advantage. To that, I should add its various applications in nuclear medicine, in both diagnosing and treating cancer.
But most importantly, Iran now has a team of experts that are capable of recycling nuclear waste and producing radioisotopes while observing international standards and all the necessary regulations in accordance with IAEA safeguards. This becomes even more significant when taking into consideration a number of other radioisotopes found in nuclear waste, which can also be derived and applied in the sectors of healthcare, agriculture, and industry, as head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization explained in response to Press TV.
It is essential that we have been able to meet the needs of our society as far as this type of state-of-the-art technology is concerned. We were able to do so as a member of the IAEA that complies with its regulations and safeguards.
Head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization added that Iran has now gained a foothold in the sector. He said not only will he be attending the upcoming IAEA General Conference in Vienna, but Iran will be holding its first exhibition there as well.
The production of cesium-137 is the result of 6 months of hard work. But Iran's Atomic Energy Organization says it is not stopping there. And very soon we will be hearing more news about the production of more radioisotopes, particularly from nuclear waste. Gizumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Libya's Government of National Unity has suspended Foreign Minister Najla Mangoush, pending an investigation. This after reports said Mangoush had met with Israel's foreign minister, Eli Cohen, in Italy last week. Libya's foreign ministry said Mangoush had rejected a meeting with Cohen, and what happened was a casual encounter. The ministry added that the interaction did not include any discussions, agreements, or consultations. It also reiterated Libya's rejection of any normalization with Israel, reaffirming the country's support for the Palestinian cause. Libya's High State Council has voiced its surprise at the reports, calling for those responsible to be held accountable. News of the meeting sparked protests in several Libyan cities. Protests erupted Sunday evening on the streets of Tripoli and its suburbs in a sign of refusal of normalization with Israel. In the northwestern city of Zawiya, young people set Israeli flags on fire and waved the Palestinian flag. Israel has launched a fresh air attack on Syria, this time targeting the international airport in the northwestern city of Aleppo. Syrian media, citing a military source, say the attack damaged the runway of the airport, putting it out of service. No casualties reported. Back in May, an Israeli airstrike on Aleppo International Airport wounded several civilians and soldiers. The facility was hit by a similar attack in March as well. The regime frequently hits the capital, Damascus, with its airstrikes also. Syria says the strikes violate its national sovereignty. It has repeatedly complained to the UN, urging the Security Council to take action against Tel Aviv. 9 years have passed since Israel's 2014 war on the Gaza Strip that left over 2,000 Palestinians dead. Human rights groups and families of victims are demanding that Israeli war criminals be held accountable for their crimes. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon has more details in the following story from Gaza.
In July 2014, Israeli forces waged an all-out war against the Gaza Strip. The war ended in late August. Israel's 50-day-long summer war claimed the lives of over 2,200 Palestinians and left over 500,000 more internally displaced. It also caused wanton and vast destruction in the tiny coastal territory. Years on, people are still grieving the loss of their loved ones and continue to demand justice.
We call on the international community to stand by the victims and their families. Israel must pay the price for its crimes. Israeli war criminals killed my brother, and I demand justice. We will never forget our loved ones, and we will never forgive their killers.
In addition to killing and maiming thousands of people, Israeli forces bombarded entire neighborhoods, including apartment buildings. After the 2014 war, the Israeli regime unleashed more wars and military aggressions on Gaza, including the 11-day war in 2021.
9 years after Israel waged a war on Gaza in 2014, victims are still waiting for justice. The International Criminal Court is still unable to bring Israeli war criminals to justice. Israel considers itself above international law, and that has encouraged it to wage more wars and commit more war crimes after the 2014 war.
Gaza, which is home to more than 2 million people, has been the subject of almost nonstop Israeli aggression since 2008.
This is the real time for the international community in order to act and to be on the side of the international law, the international humanitarian law, to get Israel accountable towards its grave violations, towards its crimes on humanity. What happened in 2014 must be reviewed and to get Israel accountable towards what have been committed during this war and after and before.
Many here blame the Israeli violence against Palestinians on what they describe as an international conspiracy of silence.
Experts say the International Criminal Court must take concrete steps in order to end Tel Aviv's impunity and bring Israeli leaders to justice. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
French politician has denounced the government's planned ban on the wearing of abaya dresses by Muslim girls in schools, describing it as policing of clothing. The remarks were made by Clémentine Autain, a member of France's left-wing opposition Unbowed Party. This after French Education Minister Gabriel Attal said the garment violated the country's strict secular laws in education. Autain slammed Attal's announcement as unconstitutional, saying that it was symptomatic of the French government's obsessive rejection of Muslims. The ban is being pushed by the right and far-right figures, while the leftist politicians say it encroaches on civil liberties. Muslim girls in French schools are also banned from wearing the Islamic headscarf. As tensions remain high, following a spat of Quran desecrations across Denmark and in Sweden, Copenhagen has announced plans to totally outlaw the improper treatment of objects of significance to a religious community, namely the Quran, the Bible, and the Torah. Rob Carter has visited Copenhagen and brings us the reactions from the scene.
Amid widespread anger over the disturbing trend of Quran desecrations across Scandinavia, the Danish government has announced plans to criminalize public mistreatment of religious objects. The new laws would permit police to act if holy scriptures, including the Quran, the Bible, or the Torah, are physically violated.
The Danish authorities' promise to change the law has been well received by many Muslim onlookers. However, there is still a lot of concern surrounding the reasons behind why this decision may be implemented. The idea that Denmark is facing a major threat from the Muslim world, rather than, for example, admitting that their freedom of speech argument is flawed, that is in itself suspect and could even be an indication or a message to the Muslim world that Denmark is not willing to adopt any responsibility for the vile desecrations and offence that have been caused. Rather, they're seeking to place blame once again on the Muslim community itself for the reasons behind this law change.
On Saturday, local Danish Muslims gathered in a show of strength to continue the pressure in hopes of the law change proposal becoming a reality. Danish coalition officials said they could enact the policy as soon as the end of the year if it is approved by Parliament. According to a draft of a bill published by the Danish Justice Ministry, those found guilty of mistreating an object with major religious significance could be fined or sentenced to up to 2 years in prison. Both Denmark and neighbouring Sweden have struggled to defend the West's free speech argument, finally wilting in the face of international condemnations. The Quran desecrations infuriated the Muslim world, sparking massive protests across the globe. Rather than owning up or apologising for their defence of hate speech, Denmark's leaders have said that the national security was the primary motivation for the ban. This was the excuse they've used for the law change. While some Muslims have been left disappointed with this reasoning, some celebrate the development as a victory in the war against Islamophobic hate speech. Robert Carter, Copenhagen.
Moving now to Ukraine, where the defense ministry says its forces have recaptured a village from Russia on the southern front line. The ministry says Robotin has been liberated and troops are now advancing southeast of the village. It is located in the Zaporizhia region. That's one of the four regions where Russia held referendums last year and annexed. Ukraine has only taken several villages on the southern front line since it began its counteroffensive in June. In more developments from the war, two people were killed in a Russian missile strike in the central region of Poltava. That's according to Ukrainian officials. Russia, in the meantime, says it has shot down a Ukrainian drone flying towards Moscow early on Monday. Three airports temporarily restricted flights as a result. Sudan's paramilitary Rapid Support Forces says it is open to a long-term ceasefire with the army and direct talks between the warring sides. The RSF leader, General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, made the announcement in a Sunday statement. He said that attempts to end the country's protracted crisis must be aimed at achieving lasting ceasefire and to address the root causes of Sudan's war. His remarks came after the Army Chief General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan arrived in Port Sudan, with government sources saying that he will travel to Saudi Arabia and Egypt for talks. Pro-democracy politicians have warned Burhan against announcing a new government, saying that it would prompt the RSF to form a parallel authority. The war in Sudan erupted on April 15 over a power struggle between the rival generals. Nearly 5,000 people have been killed and over 4.6 million displaced since then. Thousands of people have demonstrated in Niger's capital, Niamey, calling on the French forces to leave the country.
I came here to demonstrate for the departure of French troops in Niger. That's what I came to demonstrate today. And they have to hear us. I know they hear us. Every day people come here to demonstrate. People are suffering and the ECOWAS wants to increase the sanctions even more. We are here. We will resist until death.
The protesters gathered near the French military base in the capital just a few hours before the deadline given to France's ambassador to leave Niger. On Friday, the country's foreign ministry gave a 48-hour ultimatum to the ambassador to leave. Similar demonstrations were held in support of Niger's military government on Friday and Saturday. France has some 1,500 soldiers based in the West African nation. It has dismissed the ultimatum, saying the military leaders have no authority to do so.
Tensions between Niamey and Paris are running high as Niger's military leaders have given the French ambassadors 48 hours to leave the country. In a statement, Niger's foreign ministry said the decision to expel the French ambassador was taken partly due to their refusal to respond to an invitation to a meeting with Niger's Minister of Foreign Affairs. The statement added that actions by the French government have been contrary to the interests of the African nation. This prompted a response from France. Paris dismissed the ultimatum, saying Niger's junta have no authority to ask its ambassador to leave. The ultimatum was widely supported by Niger's public. Hundreds of protesters gathered in front of the French military base in Niamey on Friday, calling for the departure of foreign troops.
It's all part of the general mobilization we have here. It's to demand the departure of these invading forces, this occupying force, the French force here at Niamey Air Base. That's why we want to come to the door of this base to ask them to leave our country from here. We don't need this occupying force. We don't want them on our land.
The latest development in Niger comes amid a series of anti-French demonstrations in the African country after the army overthrew President Mohamed Bazoum in July. The military leaders in Niamey accused former colonial power France of seeking to use force in order to reinstate the ousted president. They also said the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, is an organization in the pocket of France. This is because ECOWAS has imposed tough economic sanctions on Niger following the coup and has threatened the country with military intervention.
The region is employing other elements of its instruments and engaging with the military authorities. We are hopeful that these diplomatic efforts will yield the desired outcome and make it unnecessary for the deployment of the force. Nonetheless, preparations continue towards making the force ready for deployment.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on August 6, 2023, with a meeting with the commanders, crew, and families of the 86th flotilla of the Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy. During the period of Pahlavi and Qajar rule, we had no knowledge about the sea and its capacities, despite the country's vast coastal areas and maritime resources. The Navy was preoccupied with other things. Fortunately, you didn't experience those days. There were some fair, honest people who told us what's going on in the Navy back then. There were no signs of these kinds of achievements back then. This accomplishment was presented and provided for our forces by the revolution. So the next lesson was a lesson about the revolution. The revolution saved the sea and seafaring from being put aside and forgotten in Iran. The next lesson from your achievement was your presence, which brought security. Your presence in remote areas at the far ends of the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans contributed to the country's security. You proved that the sea belongs to everyone and that the high seas do not belong to certain people. If the superpowers were able to, they would even register the oceans in their own name so that the others would have never access to them. Monopolization of the areas belonging to all humanity is one of the characteristics of the United States and the superpowers. You showed the falseness of this.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Of course, hostile actions were taken against you during this journey to hinder your mission and or to ruin it, but you overcame them. You proved that the high seas belong to everyone. One of the clear results of your work was that you showed that the high seas belong to everyone. They say, we won't allow certain ships to pass through certain straits. Nonsense. Why? The high seas belong to everyone. Everyone should be able to travel through them. People should be able to travel back and forth. The sea and the air must be free for all nations. Security for shipping and maritime transport must be ensured for all countries. Today, the U.S. attacks all tankers and helps maritime smugglers. What they are doing is a major violation. They do this in our region, and we are aware that they are doing this more or less in other places as well. These are violations of an international human law that cannot be disregarded.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
In an interview, far-right Israeli minister Itamar Ben-Gvir said that the right to life and movement for settlers in illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank trumped the right to movement for Palestinians. Palestinians have long railed against travel restrictions, including checkpoints imposed on them by Israel in the occupied West Bank. Ben-Gvir, who lives in the Jewish settlement of Kiryat Arba, near the flashpoint West Bank city of Al-Khalil, said in the interview the curbs were needed to protect his family's security.
"My right, my wife's right, my children's right to move on the roads of Judea and Samaria are more important than the right of movement for Arabs. This is the truth. My right to life tops their right to movement."
The international community, along with the Palestinians, consider settlement construction illegal. More than 700,000 Israelis live in the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds. Following Ben-Gvir's comments, the Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs condemned his remarks as racist and heinous and said it only confirms Israel's apartheid regime of Jewish supremacy. Remarks by Ben-Gvir, who has a history of anti-Arab incitement and has long taken a hardline approach to the Palestinians, infuriated some legislators in the Israeli parliament. Arab lawmaker Ahmad Tibi strongly denounced Ben-Gvir, who oversees the police, for his provocative comments.
"For the first time, an Israeli minister admits on air that Israel enforces an apartheid regime based on Jewish supremacy."
Karine El-Harar, a lawmaker from the opposition and a former minister, also reacted to Ben-Gvir's provocative remarks, blasting him as the authentic representative of the most racist cabinet Israel has ever had. The Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court defines apartheid, which is a direct symptom of military occupation, as a crime against humanity, characterized by the commission of inhumane acts such as unlawful killing, torture, and forcible transfer, which are committed to maintain an institutionalized regime of systematic oppression and domination by one racial group over another. Major human rights groups and UN officials have accused Tel Aviv of perpetuating such a system against Palestinians on top of the military occupation of their land and a decades-long campaign of genocide. Ben-Gvir, a member of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's far-right coalition, has been convicted in the past of inciting racism and of supporting a terrorist organization. More recently, Ben-Gvir has said Israel must kill thousands of Palestinians, called for flattening buildings in the occupied West Bank, and has led multiple raids into Al-Aqsa Mosque. The West Bank has been rocked by violence since early last year, especially with repeated deadly raids by the Israeli army. Israeli forces launch raids on various cities of the West Bank almost on a daily basis under the pretext of detaining what the regime calls wanted Palestinians. The raids usually lead to violent confrontations with residents. Settler attacks against Palestinians and their property are also a regular occurrence. Palestinians in Al-Khalil are particularly vulnerable to settler violence as well as Israeli surveillance. A former Israeli army general has blamed the rising wave of violence in the occupied West Bank on settlers who, as he described, go very wild in terms of provoking the local population, doing terrible acts of vandalism, sometimes terrorism against Palestinian families. The former head of the Israeli Army's Operations Directorate, Israel Ziv, said Israeli settlers are definitely encouraged by what they think is the policy of the Israeli cabinet and the coalition today. The development came after a wave of recent resistance operations in the occupied West Bank. Against the decades-long occupation by the regime, more than 200 Palestinians have been killed this year in the occupied Palestinian territories in Gaza, the highest number of fatalities since 2005. The majority of these fatalities have been recorded in the West Bank. At least 30 people have also been killed in Palestinian retaliatory attacks against Israeli settlers during that time.
Iran has been invited to become a member of the BRICS group of emerging economies, whose leaders have attended a summit in Johannesburg, South Africa, to discuss the bloc's expansion. The South African President Cyril Ramaphosa announced on Thursday that the BRICS member states agreed to admit Iran to the bloc.
"We have consensus on the first phase of this expansion process, and other phases will follow. We have decided to invite the Argentine Republic, the Arab Republic of Egypt, the Federal Democratic Republic of Ethiopia, the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates to become full members of BRICS. The membership will take effect from the 1st of January 2024.
The five current member states have reached a consensus on the first phase of this expansion process. Reacting to the news, Mohammad Jamshidi, the Iranian president's deputy chief of staff for political affairs, said Iran's membership in BRICS is a historical development and a strategic success for the foreign policy of the Islamic Republic. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said Tehran seeks to promote cooperation with the member states of the BRICS group of emerging economies. He also noted that Iran, in its foreign policy, has put the promotion of relations with all independent countries in the world on its agenda.
And the benefits of Iran's membership to BRICS is going to make history and open a new chapter and a stronger step towards justice, fairness, ethics, and sustainable and lasting peace on the international stage.
The Chinese President Xi Jinping has said the expansion of BRICS will inject new impetus to the group's cooperation mechanism. This expansion has reflected BRICS' determination for unity and cooperation. He said this membership expansion is historic. The expansion is also a new starting point for BRICS cooperation. It will bring new vigor to the BRICS cooperation mechanism and further strengthen the force for world peace and development. Russia has also welcomed Iran's application and the group's expansion to include international powerhouses. Meanwhile, South Africa's foreign minister has said that leaders of the BRICS bloc have agreed on mechanisms for considering new members, giving dozens of interested nations a path into the organization. The inclusion of Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Iran, and Egypt marks the first MENA representation in the group, and the inclusion of Argentina was championed by member Brazil. The expansion of the group is part of its plan to build dominance and to reshape global governance into a multipolar world order.
Excellencies, we are moving towards a multipolar world, and that is a positive thing. But multipolarity in itself is not enough to guarantee a peaceful or just global community. To be a factor of peace, equity, and justice in international relations, multipolarity must be supported by strong and effective multilateral institutions.
UAE President Mohammed bin Zayed said he appreciated the inclusion of his country as a new member of the important group. We respect the vision of BRICS leadership and appreciate the inclusion of the UAE as a member to this important group. We look forward to a continued commitment of cooperation for the prosperity, dignity, and benefit of all nations and people around the world. The bloc's expansion raises the question of potential de-dollarization, a process by which members would gradually switch to using currencies other than the U.S. dollar to conduct trade. The expansion also takes place at a time when some BRICS members, namely Russia and China, are locked into rising tensions with the West. Experts believe that choosing to include countries like Iran have opted to choose a foreign policy independent of the West could swing the group further toward becoming an anti-Western bloc. BRICS held its first summit in 2009 with four members and then added South Africa the following year. It launched its new development bank in 2015. More than 40 countries have expressed interest in joining BRICS, and 23 formally applied to join the club, which already represented a quarter of the global economy and 40% of the world's population.
Has reportedly begun unloading cargo from a seized tanker which is believed to have been transporting Iranian oil to Singapore. Suez Rajan, the oil tanker, has set off the coast of Texas since May. Last week, a group of American lawmakers implored the Biden administration to end the impasse and offload the tanker. Ship tracking data analyzed by American news agency The Associated Press showed the oil tanker started ship-to-ship transfer of its cargo to another tanker, the MR Euphrates, some 70 kilometers southeast of Houston. The cargo aboard that vessel is estimated to be 800,000 barrels of oil, with an estimated value of $56 million. The spokesperson for the Iranian Foreign Ministry declined to confirm the report but warned the U.S. that his country won't remain silent on the violation of its rights. Nasser Kanani slammed the measures that involved attacking oil tankers carrying Iranian oil as a brazen example of piracy. He said the general principle is that the era of hit and run has been over. The spokesman emphasized that the Islamic Republic won't remain silent on any violation of the Iranian nation's rights, will show an appropriate reaction, and cut off the hands of violators. Already, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC, has warned that those involved in offloading the Suez Rajan's cargo should expect to be struck back. The IRGC's Navy commander, Rear Admiral Ali Reza Tangsiri, warned that Iran would hold any oil company seeking to unload its crude from the vessel responsible. He said Iran would also hold America responsible. Washington has claimed to have hijacked tankers carrying Iranian oil several times, arguing that the ships had been flouting U.S. sanctions. The U.S. usually auctions off Iran's stolen assets, claiming it would use the money to pay damages to alleged victims of the Islamic Republic's actions. Meanwhile, Washington plans to sell the confiscated Iranian oil and use the money for the victims and survivors of the 9/11 al-Qaeda attacks. Tehran accuses the U.S. of stealing its oil, saying the move is illegal. Iran has warned against the provocative buildup of American forces in the Persian Gulf, saying the move comes at a time when regional countries are improving their relations. Tehran says the security of the region, especially that of the Persian Gulf waterway, must be ensured within the region itself by the Persian Gulf states. In this regard, Iran, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Oman are to form a joint naval force under China's auspices towards enhancing maritime security in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz. The Strait of Hormuz is a key strategic strip of water between the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman, where near a third of the world's oil flows through. Back in July, the U.S. military announced it has deployed 3,000 sailors and marine forces to West Asia under the pretext of protecting ships and vessels crossing the main waterways in the region. A recently released footage from Iran showed an encounter on August 17th involving the USS Bataan and USS Thomas Hutner. The video footage released by the naval force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC, showed Iranian speedboats issuing warnings to a U.S. helicopter carrier in the Strait of Hormuz, forcing the warship to ground its choppers before they can enter Iran's territorial waters. The commander of the IRGC Navy, Rear Admiral Ali Reza Tangsiri, said his force's success in monitoring maritime movements in the Persian Gulf and their vigilance in the face of threats, particularly from the warships of extra-regional countries, proved that the Iranian forces would never allow enemies to undermine security in this strategic region. Iran has made it clear that it views U.S. military vessels lurking in the waters of the Persian Gulf as a threat to its national security and a source of tension and instability in the region. The Islamic Republic has repeatedly vowed to give a decisive response to any hostile move by Washington that would disrupt the security of the strategic waterway.
Nearly 1 month into a military coup in Niger, the situation remains tense there as the country grapples with political uncertainty. As part of efforts to reverse last month's coup, a delegation from West Africa's main regional bloc, ECOWAS, has met with junta leader General Abdourahamane Tiani in the capital, Niamey. The delegation, led by Nigeria's former military leader, Abdoulsalami Abubakar, and accompanied by ECOWAS Commission President Omar Touré, has also met with Nigeria's ousted President Mohamed Bazoum. Although there has been no detail on the outcome of the talks, General Tiani said in a televised address that neither coup leaders nor the Nigerian people want war and remain open to dialogue.
In short, neither the military junta nor the people of Niger want war and remain open to dialogue. But let us be clear, if an aggression is launched against us, it will not be the easy ride that some people think it is. They will be up against 26 million Nigerians.
Tiani said the junta was pursuing its own agenda and would launch a national dialogue to consult on a transition back to democracy, which should last no longer than 3 years.
I am calling on all the living forces to engage in an inclusive national dialogue.
The aim of the body dedicated to this dialogue is to consult all the components of the people of Niger on the best ways to lay the foundations of a new constitutional life on pillars deeply rooted in our traditional and republican values.
Tiari's comments and meeting of ECOWAS representatives with coup leaders and former President Bazoum come as the bloc on Friday doubled down its threat to use force as a last resort to restore democracy in Niger. It's that an undisclosed D-Day had been agreed for possible military intervention there. This was enough reason for thousands of Nigerians to hit the streets of Niamey to throw their backing behind coup leaders. The developments in Niger come as coups are normally rejected by nature, no matter the time and place they take place. But the public support for the military junta does indeed convey a message. The disillusionment and dissatisfaction with the previous regime can be named as such. A desire for change and a belief that the military might bring stability or address grievances that have not been adequately addressed by the previous government is among reasons behind the public support for Niger junta leaders. But in the case of the West's stance toward Niger developments, what comes to the spotlight is Western countries' push for a military intervention in Niger to reverse the coup. Are they really seeking for the establishment of a civilian rule, or are there real concerns that the persistence of a military rule would not meet the demands of people across the West African nation? Western countries claim that they are involved in a fight against terrorists linked to Al-Qaeda and Daesh, but taking a glimpse at West's interests in Niger proves that seeking a civilian rule in Niger for the sake of its people would be so naive. In the case of France, Paris is seeking to maintain its grip on valuable uranium reserves in Niger. After all, the French government is entirely dependent on Niger, as some 25% of Niger's uranium production goes to France. Using that uranium to produce electricity, Paris has become a large exporter of power that goes to Germany and other European countries. This makes France huge profits, which make it hard for Paris to admit new political changes in Niger. In the case of the United States, Washington is seeing a growing tendency toward Russia among people in West African nations, including Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali. Maybe that's why, seeing its political interests in tatters, Washington is pushing for a military intervention in Niger to reinstate the pro-Western president. All what it is, the fact that Niger belongs to Nigerians and they're the ones who should decide their own fate is of very high significance. Given all the anti-West hatred among the people of Niger and other nations across the Sahel region, it seems that it is for the West to stop meddling in the affairs of those countries and let the people decide their own political future.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Ilm-e Fiqh az Ulum-e Sharifiye Islami.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
Thank you.
This is Ulama's Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mir Baghiri. Stay tuned.
در مقابل این پیغمبر گرامی چه وظایفی داریم؟ قرآن یه دستوراتی داده. من بعضیشو اشاره میکنم.
What are our duties regarding Prophet Muhammad? According to the Holy Quran, the most important duty of Muslims regarding Prophet Muhammad is obedience. Obedience means obeying his orders as if you are obeying Allah. Now, this obedience must be accompanied with three other deeds. The first one is wholehearted wish for obedience. Obedience without wish in heart has no value.
دو در طاعت خشوع افتاده. وقتی به حرف این پیغمبر گوش میدید از سر خشوع و محبت و تواضع باشه.
The second deed is humbleness. Our obedience must be done humbly and not arrogantly. And the third deed is listening well to the orders of Prophet Muhammad and Allah. If someone obeys Allah and Prophet Muhammad along with these three deeds, the results will be his or her resurrection on the Day of Judgment with prophets, the holy imams, and the best men of Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mir Baghiri. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Palestine declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The unwillingness of prominent mainstream politicians to stand up to the racist Zionist movement is a depressingly familiar story. We saw how Israel apologists dominated and ultimately destroyed Jeremy Corbyn's prospects of becoming the British Prime Minister, despite his repeated efforts to appease his Zionist detractors. But Robert F. Kennedy, who's a progressive presidential hopeful in the United States of America, has gone considerably further down the same road to perdition. Kennedy's been striving to mollify his Zionist critics by repeatedly making servile statements about the Zionist colony and telling barefaced lies about the Palestinian struggle for freedom. We'll be discussing Kennedy's attempt to ingratiate himself with the pro-Israel lobby and why it's doomed to fail after this report by Latifa Abu Chakra, who's been looking at Kennedy's backstory.
Robert F. Kennedy is the son of an assassinated US senator and the nephew of an assassinated president of the US, John F. Kennedy. RFK is well known for his lack of trust in the US intelligence agencies. Considering the question marks surrounding both his father's and uncle's deaths, you can understand why. RFK has announced his intention to run for president of the United States in 2024. He has been outspoken about the US invasion of Iraq in 2003 and has had a clear-minded analysis of the NATO war against Russia in Ukraine. He has described the war as sacrificing the flower of Ukrainian youth in an abattoir of death and destruction for the geopolitical ambition of the neocons. In a clear contrast with other candidates for the presidency, Kennedy has stated his intention to de-escalate US imperial ambitions towards the People's Republic of China. Unfortunately, he has a significant blind spot for Palestine. Despite Kennedy being branded as anti-Semitic by smear merchants, he constantly sought to ingratiate himself with the Zionist lobby. Firstly, after stating his solidarity with Roger Waters, when the Pink Floyd musician was attacked by the lobby, Kennedy swiftly climbed down after being pressured by prominent Zionist lobbyists. RFK crudely referred to the resistant Palestinian city of Jenin as a bomb factory and waxed lyrical about the morality of the Israeli military. He has grown significantly close to Israel lobbyist Shmuley Botech, who heads an organization that regularly places full-page pro-Israel ads in newspapers like The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and Washington Post. Botech also claims to have been a spiritual leader to the late pop star and alleged pedophile Michael Jackson. RFK's key ally, Botech, is a close friend of Yair Netanyahu, the bratish son of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. When hosting Yair in conversation, Shmuley Botech pontificated at great length about his intense love for the senior Netanyahu. Interestingly, RFK has also recently sought the assistance of the Zionist Organizations of America by tapping the CEO of the lobby group, Mort Klein, to work for him as an advisor on Israel. Robert F. Kennedy may be independent on foreign policy, but he is captured on Palestine.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest today is Max Blumenthal, and I spoke to him earlier via Skype. Max is a courageous investigative journalist, a groundbreaking author, and is the editor of Grey Zone News, which he founded in 2015. Earlier this month, he publicly took Robert Kennedy to task for his egregious remarks about Israel and Palestine in an interview with the US podcaster Jimmy Dore. Welcome to the show. David, say a bit about Kennedy's position on NATO's war in Ukraine.
So, I mean, his son actually went and fought in Ukraine, on the Ukrainian side, but he's been very critical of the war. I mean, you saw in the film there, he refers to it as an abattoir. And of course, that's not in any way an exaggeration. If anything, it's a sort of polite way of saying the horror that's been going on during the counteroffensive, where the slaughter of Ukrainian forces has been immense. Piles and piles of destroyed Western equipment all over the front lines. So he's been very critical of that, and he's been critical of the role of NATO in starting and provoking the war, and indeed of prosecuting the war and the supply of all those billions of dollars. Is it billions of dollars now? Of weaponry and support from the West. So he's been, when he first started to say these things, I mean, there was a kind of ripple went round the kind of anti-war left, saying, well, this is really quite interesting, a candidate who's actually opposing the war in Ukraine. And, of course, that helped him to gain some kind of profile on the left, which, of course, has been subsequently dissipated somewhat.
Yes, indeed. Well, I started by asking Max, what explains Kennedy's position on Palestine?
Well, I wasn't even aware that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. had a position on Palestine. It then emerged that he was vaguely pro-Israel, but throughout the month of May and early June, after he launched his campaign on a pro-peace platform, it wasn't really an emphasized component of his plank. Then he began to be accused of anti-Semitism, predictably, for issuing support for Roger Waters, who was under attack in Germany, because he is the world's leading celebrity advocate for the liberation of Palestinians from occupation and apartheid. I mean, how do you, you know, thank Roger Waters or show solidarity with Roger Waters on Twitter as a presidential candidate and not know that he supports Palestine? After he came under attack from people like the notorious race hustler and former reality show rabbi Shmuley Botia, RFK pleaded ignorance. I didn't know that Roger Waters had these positions, and I just was thanking him for the stand he took on COVID. But Roger Waters never took any stand against the COVID restrictions.
David, tell me about this Shmuley Botiak that Kennedy's seems to have grown pretty close to.
Well, this is a really interesting guy. He's a guy who's written self-help sex books for Jews, and he's quite popular. He's got all sorts of ways of raising money. He actually was sent by the Rebbe of his order, and he comes from the Chabad sect,
yes,
which, as we've said on previous shows, is one of the sort of extremist pro-Zionist sects. We're involved, according to the Shin Bet, in 80% of price tag killings against the Palestinians in the settlements, in particular the Hilltop Youth.
Yeah.
So this is an extremist pro-Zionist sect which used to be anti-Zionist, but Shmuley was sent by the Rebbe, the head of the sect, who's now dead, to Oxford in England, where he set up this thing called the Chlachaim Society, which was a sort of student society where he involved non-Jews as well, but it was a sort of Jewish, mainly Jewish, but also non-Jewish society, and he had a whole load of high-profile speakers come to it, including Zionists, but also some, American militarists and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And there was, of course, a difficulty with that, because what happened was that he was using the money which was coming into the society, which was a charity, not part of the university, to pay his own mortgage. And so there was a question about fraud, and one of the Jewish papers actually investigated this and went to the police about it. And so he sort of departed under a cloud. He was blacklisted by the chief rabbi. And then he goes off to America to make his fortune. And there's been all sorts of allegations there about his dealings. And so it's a really strange character for RFK to be hitched up with it. But he's hitched up with him to defend him against allegations of anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
So when he was accused of anti-Semitism, Rabbi Shmuley would come out and say, no, my friend RFK, and then they did this big video together, and RFK became, decisively Zionist and started spouting all this, Likud-like propaganda and talking points, which is really very disappointing to those on the left who said, oh, this could be an interesting candidate. So that's where he's got to, and that's the role that Shmuley has played from the Chabad sect.
Mm. Well, we know from the Jeremy Corbyn experience that tactic simply won't work. But anyway, time will tell on that. But I then asked Max what he thought the significance was of Robert Kennedy requesting the head of the Zionist Organization of America to advise him on Israel.
Well, I'm not a close friend of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., but I have had a personal relationship with him. And I know other people closer to him who are supporters of the Palestinian struggle. One of them, Charles Eisenstein, is an advisor to RFK who is extremely disgusted with what Israel has been doing for the last 70 years. And apparently RFK wasn't listening to these people. He wasn't interested in what they had to say. And that speaks to the power of the Israel lobby over in American politics, of course. But RFK went further than other candidates who tend to be advised by AIPAC and the kind of foreign policy establishment that's based around think tanks like the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, which was born out of AIPAC. He's speaking to people like Morton Klein. He's made Morton Klein his Israel policy advisor. And Morton Klein is someone who referred to Palestinians and other Arabs simply as filthy Arabs. He's never met a war against any Arab country he didn't like.
David, just say a bit more, will you, about what happened with regard to Robert F. Kennedy and his position on Roger Waters. Curious state of affairs there, wasn't it?